Good afternoon and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor of Cure Talks, joining you from India. This is Cure Talks' 94th episode, and we are talking of role of allogeneic stem cell transplants in myeloma treatment. My co-host for the day is myeloma survivor and editor of myelomasurvival.com, Gary Peterson. And supporting Gary on the panel are our myeloma survivors and advocates, Jack Aiello and Matt Goldman. The role of allogeneic stem cell transplantation is evolving in the paradigm of myeloma treatment. Despite its therapeutic potential of a myeloma cure, the use of donor stem cell transplant or allogeneic transplant is highly debated in the medical field due to the safety risks and rate of relapse. Today, we are talking to Dr. Krishna Komandurai, Medical Director of the Hematopoietic Stem Cell Transplant Program at the University of Miami Sylvester Cancer Center, to better understand allogeneic transplants, optimal timing, and how to manage graft versus myeloma effect for improved efficacy and safety. Welcome to Cure Talks, everyone. Before I hand over to Gary to carry on with the discussion, I would like to remind the audience that we will be addressing questions sent in for the panel towards the end of the discussion. If you have a question for Dr. Komandurai, you can mail it to priya@trilex.com or press 1 on your keypad and let us know so that we can bring you on air to ask your question. With that, it's over to Gary. Gary, you're on air.
Well, thank you so much, Priya, again, for always bringing us such a wonderful forum for understanding and bringing the latest and greatest information as far as myeloma treatment is concerned. And doctor, and thank you so much for coming as well. Dr. Komandurai is a medical director for adult stem cell transplant program and professor of medicine for microbiology and immunology at the University of Miami. And I think one of the very unique parts of his background is the fact that he came from MD Anderson. And I think one of the things that I think is so important is how the University of Miami has established a myeloma program and brought world-class treatment for myeloma to South Florida. Because up until they brought you and Dr. Nimmer to South Florida, I don't think there was really anything of value for the myeloma patients, I mean, in the broadest sense, not world class anyway, south of Tampa. So, you know, thank you so much for what you do and Dr. Nimmer as well from when they brought Dr. Nimmer from Memorial Sloan Kettering. But when they brought you there, they put out a news release, and it said, the University of Miami Leonard M. Miller School of Medicine has hired a top-tier innovative physician and researcher from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, which we all know happens to be probably the best in the world, or one of the best in the world, to lead the adult stem cell transplant program at the University of Miami Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Krishna Komandurai, MD, will be the director of the UM Sylvester Stem Cell Transplant Program and associate director of translational research at Miami Transplant Institution at the Jackson Memorial Hospital. There's a lot more that's said as well, and also about your extensive publications, but I won't go into that at this point. But I do want to thank you so much for bringing to South Florida an excellent myeloma treatment and research program. So welcome to the program, Doctor.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Priya. And thank you to the other advocates and to the listeners on the line.
I got to tell you that I'm not and never have been a real proponent of allogenic transplants. And the reason has been, and as many have stated before, that it has a high treatment-related mortality. And I know that you've come to Miami, and your program has probably some of the better treatment-related mortality at 70%, but still that leaves 30%. So I just wanted to let you know that that's kind of where my head has always been at, and you know, and as a result, I'm not necessarily the biggest advocate of allo transplants. But I know that one of the people that are on this particular cure panel, Jack Iola, is very much so, because he's still alive because of it. But doctor, would you please explain in layman's terms? And I ask you that because I read a large segment of a description of your background and what you're working on, and I got to tell you, it sent my my head spinning, you know, because of the complexity of the whole thing. So, if you could please dumb it down for us, I'd really appreciate it, because you obviously have a tremendous understanding of transplantation, allotransplantation, and graft versus host, and all the things associated with it. So in layman's terms, what is an allogenic transplant, and how does it differ from an autologous transplant?
So I'll be happy to do that, and I'll say it first that you noted that you're a bit of a skeptic with respect to the role of allogenic transplantation. And I think that that's actually appropriate. I'll describe again what this really is, but I'll just say it at the outset that I think in myeloma we have a less defined role for allogeneic transplantation than we do in other diseases like acute myeloid leukemia, which is the primary disease for which allogeneic transplant is performed, where the indications are actually very clear and that this is a quite safe, reasonable, and standard of care option. But in myeloma, and I think that we'll spend this hour talking about that in myeloma, there are greater risks. There are clear benefits for a subset of patients, but the data are more murky. And I think it's important that we thoughtfully have that discussion. I think that's where we'll focus today. So I think that skepticism is not necessarily out of place. And I'd like to, I think we'll explore today both the positive and the negative aspects of this approach versus the other approaches. And I think one reason that things are more murky is because myeloma in general is a very positive field. There are so many other things that have been developed, both with respect to the role of autologous transplants and the role of emerging therapies, including the standard therapies now, including IMID-based therapy like lenalidomide, bortezomib, and other novel agents that are in the developmental pipeline. So let me answer your question first. What is an autologous and what is an allogeneic transplant? So I think to start off answering that question, I'd like to really start at the most basic part of that, and that is what the bone marrow does. So the bone marrow, and again, I apologize because many of you will know this very, very well, but the bone marrow is really a factory for blood cells. And to really to live each day, we need red blood cells that carry oxygen to our tissues. We need platelets. Platelets are actually fractions of cells that are produced in the bone marrow that help to clot the blood. So if I cut myself shaving, the platelets will go and plug the initial hole and start the clotting process. And then we have a number of white blood cells that are produced in the bone marrow. And those white blood cells include neutrophils. Neutrophils are cells that keep our bacteria, which we have billions of bacteria in our body, in check. And they live typically only about a week or so. And then there are the longer-acting white blood cells, longer-lived white blood cells that include the lymphocytes, and they include B cells and T cells. And these cells live for decades and protect us from viral infections and other infections, not typically the bacterial infections. And indeed, these different white blood cells can, in some cases, become cancerous. And indeed, multiple myeloma is a cancer of plasma cells, which are cells that normally would produce antibodies that protect us from infection, but in myeloma patients have become cancerous and then build up in the bone marrow from levels that would normally be very small levels to increasing levels as the disease progresses. A small number of the cells in the bone marrow, so of the white blood cells, typically less than 1 in 100 cells are what we call progenitor cells or stem cells. And these cells give rise to really all of those different blood cell types. So they ultimately can differentiate into white blood cells, they can become red blood cells, or they can become platelets. And if we take those cells out, those cells are like the seeds of a plant in that one cell can actually give rise to multiple different cell types. So a seed can grow into an oak tree and that has obviously leaves and bark and roots that are quite different from each other, and the progenitor cells can be transplanted. So when patients come to me first for autologous transplant, they often have the misconception that we're curing the disease by somehow transplanting cells. That is, that the transplant itself is curing the disease. But indeed, what we're doing, and many of you who have experienced this or are considering it will already know this, but in myeloma, what we're doing is often, I think I explained to me by an analogy related to the garden. So if we have weeds in the garden and we have a prized plant next to the weeds, and we try to use weed killer, for example, to get rid of those weeds, we may end up poisoning the plant that we're trying to save. In other words, if we let the weeds grow, the weeds will eventually outgrow the healthy cells. And indeed, when myeloma eventually progresses, the healthy blood cells aren't produced in normal levels. And this is one of the primary reasons that myeloma can be fatal if it's untreated. So if we try and, again, treat the weeds with the healthy plant in place, we may end up poisoning the good cells. And so the analogy extended to myeloma and autologous transplants is if we give chemotherapy, especially at high doses, we can poison the healthy blood stem cells. So in myeloma and autologous transplantation, by taking out the healthy blood stem cells, that is by collecting them, and these days we collect them through the peripheral blood, we can save them outside the body, and then we can give high doses of chemotherapy. So in the analogy with the garden, if we take out the healthy plant and give high doses of weed killer, we now don't have to worry about poisoning the plant. We can let the rain wash away the weed killer, and then when the weed killer is gone, we can transplant back the plant that came from the garden. But you can imagine in other diseases, the bone marrow itself may be not functional. There are marrow failure diseases where the bone marrow can't, the healthy stem cells can no longer be removed and transplanted because they've been destroyed in the context of the disease process. Or in diseases like acute leukemia or in myeloma, it may be impossible to get sufficient numbers of healthy cells because the bone marrow is now filled with malignant cells. And so donor transplants were first done for diseases where it wasn't thought to be possible to take healthy blood stem cells from the bone marrow. And instead, if you imagine, again, taking the garden analogy, that if you now wipe out the weed killer, but you have no good stem cells left, you now go to the garden store and get new cells or new plants from somebody else and then replant them. Doing a donor transplant means that we're getting those progenitor or stem cells from another individual. Now, the catch is that donor transplantation requires immunologic matching, because when we transplant cells from another individual, especially when we get those cells from the bone marrow or from the peripheral blood, we're also transplanting immune cells from that donor that recognize foreign tissues and foreign things. The immune system of the donor, of course, is supposed to protect the patient, the donor, from viral infections and from foreign invaders like bacteria, and other pathogens. And if we transplant those cells into the recipient, we're basically putting the immune cells in an environment that's completely foreign, even if well matched. And so in the donor transplant setting or the allogeneic transplant setting, we have immune effects that come into play. So when we do an autologous transplant and we transplant a patient's own stem cells back, they're, of course, in their own environment, and there's no immunologic reaction. But when we transplant cells from a donor, we can have the donor cells attack the recipient. And we'll talk about this more, but that can have both good effects and bad effects. And the good effect can be that the immune system cells can actually eliminate cancer cells that aren't susceptible to chemotherapy. So we have what's called a graft versus malignancy effect, or in the case of myeloma, graft versus myeloma effect. But we can also have a graft versus host disease effect, that is, the healthy cells of the donor attack the recipient, seeing it as foreign, until it becomes comfortable in the recipient's body, which can take typically 6 to 8 months. And that actually requires recipients of donor transplants or allogeneic transplants to get immunosuppressive drugs to basically keep the donor immune system calm until it finally becomes comfortable in the recipient, which eventually happens, when the donor cells become tolerant or comfortable in the recipient, and then the immune system can then be unleashed by tapering off the immunosuppressive drugs. So the two, I would say, fundamental differences between autologous and allogeneic transplant are, first, that the patient is not the source of the stem cells, but rather we have to find a compatible donor. And the second thing is the difference between the donor and the recipient lead to these immunologic differences, which can both mediate good effects, that is, anti-cancer effects, but also potential toxicities.
Well, thank you, Doctor. I appreciate that, and I'm sure all the listeners do as well. Now, usually the allo is not a first-line treatment, I understand, for myeloma, mainly due to the high first-year death rates of 30 to 50%. I know yours is about 30, which is some of the best. But what has changed, if anything, to alter this mindset of it not being a first-line treatment for myeloma?
So let me come back to the first-line treatment for myeloma. I think that's obviously a critical question for many of your listeners. But let me talk about that death rate. So you quoted, again, typically one-year survival rates at our center of about 70%, and that's maybe a little bit better than expected for our risk population. But I want to point out that of those patients, again, the majority of the patients that receive allogeneic or donor transplants in the United States and at our center are not myeloma patients. Very few myeloma patients receive allogeneic transplants compared to other diseases, especially the leukemias, including acute myeloid leukemia. When we look at that, for example, at our center, the 30% death rate, it's important to note that only about half of that is actually related to treatment-related complications, and the other half is actually due to disease relapse. So the important number, I think, as we think about myeloma, is what is the likelihood of dying due to complications of the treatment? And you're actually right, in stating historical rates of death due to treatment, that is, complications related to the role of donor transplants, that were in the range of 30 to 50% in the early days of transplant. So I finished my training in oncology a little less than 20 years ago. And at that point, the rates of death due to the treatment itself were actually in the 30 to 50% rate. We would typically quote patients who had a brother or sister transplant, a one-year rate of dying due to complications of the transplant of 30 to 40%, and it might be higher in the unrelated donor setting. And indeed, it was known early on that myeloma patients, probably partially due to the nature of their disease and the fact that the bone marrow was involved, the age of myeloma recipients, which on average at diagnosis is typically 65 to 70, and also the effects of the prior treatments that myeloma patients were getting at that time, that myeloma patients had a higher rate of dying due to donor transplants than patients with acute leukemia, for example. But I think it's important, and I want to just quote the rates of actual death due to transplants in more recent studies. So Amrita Krishnan, who is at City of Hope Cancer Center, led a multiple a bone marrow transplant clinical trials network study where they performed transplant as first-line therapy using modern approaches where lower doses of chemotherapy than the therapies that we used to prepare the patient for transplant 20 years ago were used. And in that study, the non-relapse mortality, that is the likelihood of dying due to the treatment as opposed to due to the disease, was about 22% in patients at 3 years in high-risk patients, and in lower-risk patients was actually 11% at 3 years. Other studies have looked at the rates of complication-related death. Dr. Freites in San Antonio did an analysis for the International Bone Marrow Transplant Registry and showed that in the first 3 years after transplant, that patients who had an autologous transplant and then relapsed and then had an allogeneic transplant following relapse had an 11% rate of dying due to complications. And again, a more recent European multicenter study that was published again in 2012 demonstrated that the rate of this was published by Patriarca in the Biology of Blood Marrow Transplant, showed that the rate of dying due to complications of donor transplants was around 22% at 2 years. So I don't want to trivialize this because 10 to 20% rates of death due to complications is not trivial. And these days, an autologous transplant is associated with very low rate of dying early after transplant. Typically, at most centers, 1 to 2%, and our rates are well below 1% if we look at our results over the last several years. So 10 to 20% is significantly higher. But we also have to remember that allogeneic transplant is typically done usually after a failure of autologous transplant and often in multiply relapsed patients. So it's difficult to, I think, compare, you know, that's not an apples-to-apples comparison. But the reason for that risk is because of, you know, the rates of graft-versus-host disease and other complications. One of the things that has changed over the 20 years that I've been in the field is that we recognize now, as I talked to you about, that the immune system can actually help to cure patients' cancer. So it can kill off the cells that are resistant to chemotherapy. So one of the surprising things is that we now use much lower doses of chemotherapy prior to donor transplants than we used 15 or 20 years ago. 15 or 20 years ago, we thought that we needed to use very intensive chemotherapy because we didn't understand actually that the immune system was playing a role in preventing relapse. So we often used irradiation-containing regimens or combinations of powerful chemotherapy agents. We now often use what we call reduced intensity conditioning, which means that we use kinder, gentler chemotherapy that still wipes out the recipient's blood cells, but does it in a way that's not likely to be toxic to the lungs and the liver and other organs. So while we still have complications typically due to graft-versus-host disease, the complications due to organ toxicities of high-dose chemotherapies are not necessarily a thing of the past, but are dramatically reduced and are relatively low. But it's true that this higher rate of dying early that is due to the treatment has prevented it from becoming an excellent first-line therapy. And indeed, the studies that earlier on suggested that in initially diagnosed patients that the combination of an autologous followed by an allogeneic transplant was better were found not to be confirmed in large trials. The trial that I talked about by Amrita Krishnan, which is a trial of several hundred patients who, after an autologous transplant, were then randomized if they had a donor to a sibling transplant or a donor transplant, or in some cases, patients were given a second autologous transplant, showed that there was no benefit to the allogeneic transplant in addition to the autologous transplant. And the reason for the lack of additional benefit, despite lower relapse rates, was that increased risk of dying. So it's not been shown as an upfront therapy to be better than autologous transplantation, either alone or in tandem. And you're right, I think, to be skeptical as allogeneic transplant in general for most patients as an upfront therapy because of that. But again, I do think that the mortality rates are much lower than you quoted because of these improvements in the way that we do transplants relative to the initial approach.
Yeah, I was looking at the information from Be the Match, which a lot of people provide information for, and yours were, some of the, I think they started at like probably 50% and went all the way to like 23%. So 30% was pretty significantly pretty good. There wasn't many that were at that rate.
But remember, that's the rate of dying during the first year of all causes. Not, and again, many of those patients have high-risk leukemia, for example, and have a very, you know, likelihood of that many of those deaths are due to the disease itself. In other words, not due to the treatment. So
I understand. And but I didn't see that before. So this is a potential cure. I think most people will agree with that, you know, and the death rate is the thing that prevents a lot of people from even trying it. But it does, in fact, even though you have an allo transplant, there is a possibility for relapse. So what is the relapse rate for an allo? And what, if anything, has been done to reduce this relapse rate?
So that's a very good question. And I think that again, one of the reasons that it's I think, healthy to be a bit skeptical about myeloma is that the relapse rates are higher than, for example, with acute leukemia, which is, again, the dominant reason that allogeneic transplants are done in the United States. If we look at acute myeloid leukemia, for example, only about 25% of patients who have transplants will relapse at any point after the transplant. Where for myeloma, you know, again, it varies according to the risk of the patient population and how many lines of therapy that they've had. And again, in allogeneic transplant studies, patients tend to be on the higher risk end of the spectrum because they've, you know, often aren't subjected to those upfront risks without, you know, being, again, in a difficult position. But the relapse rates have been, and again, in Amrita Krishnan's study, you know, she noted that relapse rates in allogeneic transplant were for patients who had autologous followed by an allogeneic transplant up front were around 46% in low-risk patients and around 38% in higher-risk patients. So this is definitely higher than what we would expect for, again, a similar patient population with acute myeloid leukemia, for example, and one of the reasons that allogeneic transplantation upfront is not a standard therapy, where in acute myeloid leukemia it is absolutely standard and has been definitely shown to be the appropriate thing for most patients who have a standard to high risk disease. So again, obviously, so those are the rough numbers. It will vary, you know, according to patient population, of course, like results in any other trial. So if you take a patient population that's upfront and low risk, the relapse rates will be lower than patients, of course, who failed multiple therapies.
Well, thank you, doctor, for that. I appreciate that. I really didn't know what that was. So, yeah, your input certainly helped me to understand that much better. Now, could you, you know, one of the things that I've heard is that you can, you know, have a great response with an allo for your disease, but you can still have what's called graft versus host disease, and that can make your life pretty miserable. So why does this happen, and what can be done to minimize it, if anything? And then again, you mentioned before, what you really want is graft versus tumor, and that's what, in fact, provides the cure potential, but you can have a pretty miserable life, I understand, if you have some graft versus host disease. And, you know, what percentage of patients get this, and what kind of experience do you see that they have?
So that's a very good question. It's a critical area, and actually the focus of my laboratory research. So to explain this in a way that I think your listeners will understand, so most people think of rejection, for example, if in the solid organ transplant setting, and it's easy to understand that if, for example, if you give me your kidney, that my immune system is likely to reject your kidney. Okay. So in other words, that's the process of transplant rejection. But in a donor transplant, if you think about what's happening, is we're actually transplanting a whole entire immune system. So the immune system of the donor is healthy, and it's recognizing everything in the recipient potentially as foreign. And there are certain organ systems like the skin and the liver and the intestines that tend to be particularly susceptible to the immunologic reactions where the donor immune system realizes it's in a foreign place and starts to attack everything around it. Now, again, I did explain that is associated with a good effect, which is called the graft versus malignancy, or in this case, the graft versus myeloma effect. Well, to do a transplant at all from a donor, we actually have to put the brakes on the donor immune system by giving immunosuppressive drugs, just like the solid organ transplant recipient has to be given drugs to prevent the recipient from rejecting the donor kidney in that case. But in the donor transplant setting, we actually give immunosuppressive drugs typically for at least 3 to 4 months, and then we can usually taper them off from 6 to 8 months. But a subset of patients, despite the donor being given drugs to damp down the immune system or to put the brakes on the immune system, the donor immune system will still find a way to recognize, the foreignness of the recipient and attack the recipient. Now, of course, that depends on how closely matched the donor and the recipient are. Brothers and sisters have a 1 in 4 chance of matching, and brother or sister transplants have a lower rate of graft versus host disease. Unrelated donors are slightly more likely, obviously, to cause graft versus host disease in the recipient because they're despite having good matching, they're less closely matched than brothers or sisters. Now, graft versus host disease has two flavors, without getting into too many specifics, but it comes in an acute form, which happens typically in the first 3 months after transplant. And then there's a chronic form, which can happen between 3 months and even years out from transplant. The acute form happens in brother or sister recipients typically 20% to 30% of the time, and a slightly higher fraction of unrelated donor recipients. But the chronic form of graft versus host disease happens in probably about 40% of brother or sister recipients, and as many as 50% or more of unrelated donor recipients. Now, it's true that in many patients, graft versus host disease can happen and then can actually be treated with more aggressive immunosuppression and it goes away. Unfortunately, a subset of patients will have graft versus host disease that impairs quality of life. And again, we hope that that's associated with a good effect, that is, freedom from relapse. But in some patients, unfortunately, graft versus host disease can be a significant impairment. So they're now trading a myeloma life or a malignancy, life with malignancy, with a life with basically a chronic immunologic or inflammatory condition. And in some cases, the quality of life impairment can be severe, but fortunately, that's a small fraction of patients. If you look at patients in general, for example, with acute leukemia where we have much higher numbers, about 80% of patients are off immunosuppression completely by about 2 years off after transplant. So in other words, the vast majority of patients are living without graft versus host disease. A subset of patients will have graft versus host disease, and I sometimes tell people this may be like diabetes. You may be cured of your disease, but my father, who's been a diabetic for decades and yet a healthy person, can't forget he's a diabetic and may have an immunologic consequence or problem that has to take for which he has to take medication. That individual can live a high quality of life. Obviously, a subset of patients will have impairment of quality of life. But it is this need to balance the bad effects of graft versus host disease with the good effects of graft versus malignancy that's really a focus. And many of us are trying to find better ways of doing this. And there are attempts. Unfortunately, many of the immunosuppressive drugs that can prevent graft versus host disease also increase the risk of infections or increase the risk of relapse. And therefore, we kind of trade one consequence for another. For example, taking out the T cells from a donor graft will decrease the likelihood of graft versus host disease, but will increase the likelihood of infections in the recipient, and most of us think will increase the risk of relapse. So this is kind of a central question, and I think a focus of much research to try to find better ways of suppressing the immune system that can allow the good effects of the immune system to happen without the bad effects.
Well, thank you, Doctor. I appreciate that. At this point, I'd like to open up the questions to the panel. Jack, Ayola, are you there?
Yep, I'm on, Gary.
Okay, so, Jack, ask your questions.
I will do that. Thank you very much for being on the call, Doctor.
Thank you.
And just to let you know, I'm the allo patient that had an allo, but I'm not necessarily for it or against it. It's just that when I was diagnosed in 95 and a tandem auto didn't work very long and there weren't many other treatments around then, in 98, the full allo that I went through with TBI was essentially the only salvage therapy had left to me. And when you talk today about aloes, I think not all aloes are the same. There's a lot with respect to the condition in the aloe. I hear lots with respect to T-cell depletion or non-T-cell depletion. You hear the terminology of myeloablative versus non-myeloablative, full versus mini versus reduced intensity. So if a doctor is proposing an aloe to a patient, can you say a little bit more about the differences in conditioning and why one might consider one versus the other?
Absolutely, and it's a very good question. So, and congratulations to you. And I think that your story actually summarizes why allogeneic transplantation has an important place. There are clearly patients who can get standard therapies and have an autologous transplant and be disease-free for 8 or 10 years or longer. And those patients clearly, I think, shouldn't be thinking about allogeneic transplant. But then there are other patients who have either very high-risk disease up front or have exhausted other therapies, including autologous transplant, for which they're likely to face, you know, a myeloma-related death. And I think for those patients, clearly, even if there are risks, allogeneic transplantation, which is known to be curative and can be curative in patients like you, you're 20 years out, that's wonderful. I think that's actually a great lesson. So you asked the question. So I explained that in the early days of transplant, we thought that donor transplant really cured patients really just by kind of wiping the slate clean and giving a healthy donor bone marrow. We did not at that point imagine that the donor immune system could actually help to eliminate cancer cells. So we thought that everything had to be done with the chemotherapy and or radiation. So we generally thought the more intensive, the better. So let's push patients to the brink of death and let's use the most intensive chemotherapy and or chemotherapy and radiation possible because that'll kill the most cancer cells. And ironically, when we realized that the immune system actually was doing the work, and we realized this between 1990 and 1995, that it became definitively, the case that we realized that the immune system could cure cancers, indeed, we said, well, let's use less intensive chemotherapy because we're indeed probably causing excessive mortality related to organ toxicities, like toxicities to the lung or toxicities to the liver. And indeed, it turns out that those more intensive chemotherapies are also associated in some cases with higher rates of graft versus host disease. So we started using what we call reduced intensity chemotherapy. And we know that, in fact, in the early days of transplant, and when I started my career, we didn't transplant anybody over the age of 60 because nobody could tolerate those intensive combinations. And that, of course, is a big problem because diseases like acute myeloid leukemia and diseases like myeloma occur most commonly in individuals between the age of 60 and 70 and often over the age of 70. So if the treatment was so extreme and dire that it couldn't be used, it wasn't of much value. So it turns out that using lower intensity chemotherapy, and again, the terms that you use, reduced intensity really refers to less intensive chemotherapy that's less likely to cause harm in the recipient, but usually chemotherapy that if you give it to the recipient, the recipient's blood cells won't grow back, okay? But that means kind of kinder, gentler conditioning chemotherapy. You also asked the question about T-cell depletion. Well, normally we give peripheral blood stem cells, and the stem cells from the donor include immune cells that, can cause graft-versus-host disease, those lymphocytes and T-cells, the T-cells which are a subset of the white blood cells called lymphocytes that I talked about. Well, certain centers, and I think Memorial Sloan Kettering in particular for your listeners who have considered treatment there, is a proponent of removing the T-cells from the donor graft. Well, we know from acute leukemia studies that when you take out the T cells from the donor graft, you get more infections in the recipient because it makes sense. You're not transferring the white blood cells that help to protect the recipient from infection. But we know that in the setting of acute leukemia that you get more relapses. Now, the Sloan-Kettering group has been very dogmatic about the benefits of T cell depletion, and they cite their data suggesting that their relapse rates don't seem to be much lower with T-cell depletion. But I would say that the prevailing view, and certainly the view in general of centers like MD Anderson and others, is that when you take out the T-cells and you reduce the risk of graft-versus-host disease, that you pay a price with respect to increased rates of infection and relapse. So there are, I think, prevailing local customs, right? And I think at Sloan Kettering, it's one of the fewer programs in the country, that where you're likely to be recommended a T-cell depleted transplant. And if you have a transplant there, my view is that you're more likely then to have infection or relapse. Again, you know, the physicians there may disagree. The vast majority of programs in the country will give you the cells that are collected from the donor, which include T-cells. And again, we'll use different types of conditioning that may be more intensive or less intensive. Again, if the disease is less robust at the time of transplant, you can imagine that it becomes safer to use less intensive chemotherapy. So somebody who is in a complete remission might not need as much chemotherapy to get the disease in check. And then the donor immune system, because the donor immune system has less work to do. But you can imagine if you have a patient with a lot of disease, and this has been proven in the setting of acute leukemia, less so in the setting of myeloma, that it helps to have some intensity. And I often tell people, like, you know, it's like knocking a bully down before, you know, somebody else can finish him off, that the chemotherapy plays a role in tandem with the immune system. So that reduced intensity refers to basically the intensity of the chemotherapy, which along with the immune system effects are the two things that help to keep the disease in control and can prevent patients from relapsing and indeed can cure patients a subset of the time like you.
Thank you. My other question, and I think you already answered it. I just want to make sure I understood the answer. My other question had to do with high-risk patients. So, for example, I'm a deletion 17P patient who has failed an auto transplant and most other therapies, and I'm being recommended to get an allo. Did I understand you to say that, unfortunately, high-risk patients have also a higher rate of relapse than standard-risk patients from an allo transplant?
They do. I think that it's common sense that, you know, disease is likely, no matter what treatment you throw at it, to be more likely to relapse, right? On the other hand, you know, it's not always true that the more risky things are going to achieve better outcomes. There are, you know, times when you can't overcome that risk. But you're a perfect example of somebody who had high risk, was likely, you know, I mean, we don't think of myeloma typically as a curable disease, but would have, you know, been extraordinarily unlikely to live, you know, for more than a year or two, let alone 20 years. So I think that if you look at the modern role, you know, again, there were early studies that were single institution studies that were not randomized that suggested in upfront patients that autologous followed by allogeneic transplant did better than what we would have expected with autologous transplants alone. But then that led to a large randomized study that I talked about that was published in Lancet Oncology, and again, Dr. Krishnan was the first author, that failed to show a benefit upfront in standard risk patients. But clearly, there seem to be subsets of patients that we know do very poorly in myeloma. And they include patients, for example, with plasma cell leukemia who have high amounts of the malignant plasma cells that even circulate in the blood. And there are patients who have chromosomal abnormalities, and some of the genetic abnormalities include the deletion of chromosome 13, the deletion of chromosome 17P, and then other chromosomal abnormalities like translocations of chromosomes 4 and 14. And then there are new modern gene expression profiling signatures that appear to be associated with multiple, where there are multiple mutations that can be assessed by modern methods that appear to be associated with, you know, particular resistance to standard approaches. And I think that if you look at what most of us would say about the role of allogeneic transplant, one is that we should continue to ask studies to see if there are subsets who either at relapse or upfront, if they have very high-risk disease, may be cured with allogeneic transplant or have better survival with allogeneic transplant than they would with these traditional approaches, which we know with these, you know, subsets of patients, you know, respond very poorly. Right? Now, I have to say, it's not proven yet that allogeneic transplant is the right thing to do, but I think that we know that there are patients like you who I think it would say, you know, would be virtually impossible to have expected you to be alive 20 years later, given how you presented, right? So it's, well, it's common sense. Now, the question is, which subsets of patients should take the risk of the higher treatment-related mortality, even though that treatment-related mortality is much better than it used to be? And I think that's the question. So I think that if you ask me, again, not to oversimplify, I would say that there is a subset of patients who have failed autologous transplant and you know, either have failed additional therapy after autologous transplant or have had a very short response to autologous transplant that we know historically are likely to do poorly, and they should be considered for allogeneic transplant. And there's another group of patients either who have plasma cell leukemia, which is a very rare but very, you know, terrible subset, and there are patients with these high-risk genetic signatures, whether they're chromosomal abnormalities or gene expression signatures, that appear to do very poorly. And I think in those patients, we need to know whether allogeneic transplantation can achieve better outcomes, as we suspect it may, than the traditional approaches.
Thanks very much, Commandori. And just to clarify for the listeners, in 1995, they didn't even determine if I was high risk or not. So I wasn't saying that I was a deletion 17P candidate.
I see. Right. No, I appreciate your clarification, because I thought maybe that there was bank samples or something else that was done afterward, because absolutely those techniques were not available at that time.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Matt, you online?
Yes, I'm here.
Your question?
Yep. Thanks for your time, doctor. You've kind of touched on a couple of my questions, but you've brought about other questions, so I'm going to go off script a little bit. You talked about, for the donor, you put the brakes on the immune system for a couple months leading up to the transplant.
No, that's actually in the recipient after the cells are infused. We don't do anything to the donor. We just collect cells from the donor. That's right. So we put, in other words, once the cells are infused in the recipient, the donor's immune system, of course, would attack the recipient, you know, in almost all cases. So we give the recipient immunosuppressive drugs after the donor's immune system has been infused.
And how long do you sort of, on average, keep the recipient on those immunosuppressive drugs?
So on average, we would typically continue them at full doses for somewhere between 2 to 4 months, and then we typically would taper them, you know, often a schedule might be we continue them at full doses for around 3 months, and then we drop them by about 25% each month over the next 3 to 4 months, so that you know, in a good situation where the recipient's not experiencing any graft versus host disease and is doing well, by 6 to 8 months after transplant, they're off the drugs.
And is that similar to what an autologous transplant patient would go through in terms of suppressing the immune system and making...
Absolutely not. An autologous transplant is the patient's own cells, so we don't have to suppress the immune system at all, and the risks are very low. There is no risk of the patient's own stem cells causing problems. And indeed, autologous transplant, really the only risk, the major risk, is the first couple of weeks after the transplant, when the blood cells haven't recovered to kind of healthy levels. The immune system is more suppressed in all, you know, many cancer patients, including myeloma patients. And, you know, autologous transplant patients will have a somewhat higher risk of infection, but it dramatically diminishes, and the likelihood of having fatal complications is very, very low beyond the first couple of weeks after transplant. So that's quite different than the donor transplant setting, where patients are on immunosuppression for a prolonged period of time, and if they do have graft versus host disease, that 6 months can become a year or two or longer in that small subset that have more serious graft versus host disease. So it's that the need for immunosuppressive drugs in the donor transplant setting that makes it a much more, you know, risky and cautious proposal, and requires much you know, more complexity of care and expertise.
Mm-hmm. And so, again, for the donor, there's no risk or really nothing
really,
to worry about.
I think very, very limited risk of, you know, discomfort. Again, we sometimes collect the cells from the blood, and we have to, you know, get IV access sometimes in a subset of patients who have small veins. In some patients, not so many these days, we do operative bone marrow harvest, but the vast majority of patients, almost all brothers and sisters, and, you know, these days the majority of unrelated donors have cells collected from the peripheral blood. There's some minor, you know, I would say, discomfort and some minor risks, but, you know, very, very low risk. No one should really think about it. And you know, there are, you know, thousands of unrelated donors each year who donate for patients who are not part of their family and safely recover and typically back to work within days.
Mm-hmm. And a related donor or donor could be a donor more than once, I would imagine, right?
They could, though, again, we, you know, that you wouldn't often do a transplant more than once because, again, you know, typically You know, this is not something that's frequently done. You know, they're less than, you know, they're the number of allogeneic transplants for myeloma in the country, you know, are probably in the hundreds, as opposed to, you know, maybe 8,000 that are done for overall, you know, in for mostly for leukemia and other diseases. So we could do a transplant with a donor twice, but it would be extraordinarily unusual.
So you haven't done an allo, the same patient hasn't that you've ever?
No, we will. You know, there are patients who, for example, will lose, you know, rarely the donor graft kind of is lost because there's an infection in the recipient and the blood cells drop and we might retransplant from a donor. There are patients who, you know, appear to be cured, again, like, you know, situations like where, you know, Jack had, but, you know, but then would experience a very late relapse, not necessarily an early relapse, but if somebody relapsed maybe 5 years later, we might consider another allogeneic transplant. So, you know, those of us who have been transplanters for a long time have certainly seen circumstances where we would do a second allogeneic transplant and on occasion from the same donor, but it's not common for myeloma or other diseases.
Okay. And then I think my last question is for myeloma patients that are kidney impacted, is an allo transplant something that might totally just demolish those kidneys? You know, because
yeah, so that's a very, very good question. So the primary immunosuppressive drugs are a class of drugs called calcineurin inhibitors, and they include tacrolimus and cyclosporin. And these drugs, unfortunately, cause abnormal kidney function in even healthy individuals. And so there's definitely higher risk in patients who have baseline kidney function abnormalities, and typically patients who have a creatinine, and you know those individuals who have experienced kidney problems will know what that number is, above the level of 2 are usually not considered for donor transplants because of typically the risks of the immunosuppressive drugs causing further kidney problems, because what you don't want to do is to do a donor transplant and then have that be complicated by kidney failure, because that increases the risk of death and causes other problems. So that's
right.
Absolutely right, that I think that patients who, again, it's fine if patients have, you know, many patients with myeloma will have kidney problems, but then when treated, that kidney function will improve dramatically. And that's actually not a contraindication, but ongoing kidney problems, especially at the time of transplant, are a concern.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thanks, Matt. Really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Priya, could you bring online some callers?
Thank you, Gary. Dr. Kumandurai, we have a list of questions I think I've shared with you. I believe we've answered quite a few of them, but let's just go through the rest for our listeners. The first one is from our listener who asks, do you need to be in complete remission to do a full allo as part of a first-line therapy?
So the answer is no, but we know that allogeneic transplant, because so the immune system is better at finishing, you know, the job when the disease is relatively responsive. Okay, so I would say that in most cases, and if you look at the you know the trials, that they normally would require at least a partial response or a very good partial response that is more than a 50% or 90% reduction. So the answer is that the patients typically don't have to be in a complete response. And I want to specifically plug, you know, there is a large study of allogeneic transplant. One of the things you've heard me say more than once is that I think that allogeneic transplant should be done ideally in an academic center in the context of a clinical trial. And there's actually a very large clinical trial that's being done through the Bone Marrow Transplant Clinical Trials Network and will be available at many academic centers around the country that looks specifically at the value of allogeneic transplant for the groups of patients that we talked about, either very high-risk patients up front or patients who had a short remission after an autologous transplant. So these are the patients that we think, you know, should be, you know, it would be reasonable to subject them to the risk of allogeneic transplant because we know that they're likely to do poorly otherwise and that they can be cured. And if you look at the criteria for that trial, the BMT-CTN study, again, it does require one of these high-risk types and typically requires responsive disease, but not a complete response.
Thank you, Doctor. The next question is there an age limit for a patient who is doing well after relapse on Velcade maintenance to go on for an allo?
So that's a good question. So at our center, and I think many centers, we really don't think twice about doing allogeneic transplants. Again, in appropriate patients, at least to the age of 65, and routinely we are doing transplants up to the age of 70. Above the age of 70, we get very cautious with respect to making sure patients are in particularly good health. We all know individuals who are healthy who at the age of 73 are you know, going to the gym multiple times a week, and then we know people who are bedbound at the age of 73. So not every 73-year-old is of equivalent, you know, risk. But I would say in general, in most centers up to the age of 65 or 70 is again not a contraindication. The BMT-CTN study that I talked to you about specifically includes patients only under the age of 65, so that has an upper limit of 65. But that's true. And certainly one of the groups of patients that we would consider upfront treatment are patients who are very young, and unfortunately there are patients who are diagnosed with myeloma in their 30s or their 40s, and we know that those patients are much more likely to die of their myeloma than a patient who is obviously 75 at the time of diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Doctor. Next question is, recently radio-labeled antibodies are of particular interest for conditioning regimens for allogeneic transplants. Could you explain to us how they're going to be helpful?
So that's a great question. You know, I talked to you about one of the reasons that bad things happen after transplant, and that's historically the high doses of radiation and chemotherapy, which can affect organs like the liver or the lungs. The idea with radio-labeled antibodies is antibodies are ironically produced by plasma cells, you know, healthy plasma cells, but they can, you know, be engineered such that they can be like smart bombs, basically. They can go and they recognize a specific protein on the body, and they are now antibodies that are in clinical trials, and some of these were developed at the University of Washington, which is at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center, which is a pioneering center, which can basically home to the bone marrow without affecting nearly as much. You know, there are some stray antibodies that are radio-labeled that can end up in the liver or the lungs, but the idea is that more of those cells end up in the bone marrow and therefore can get rid of, you know, cause damage, you know, to the cancer cells in the bone marrow with doing less harm to ordinary tissues. So in animal model systems, this appears to be promising, but I would caution that we don't have human clinical trials, despite the fact that this is a promising intellectual, strategy that seems appealing, that this is really going to work. Because, you know, one problem is you could infuse these cells, and although you think that they're going to end up in the bone marrow, they end up kind of trafficking through the lungs, for example, and causing some bystander damage while they're there. So this is an interesting strategy that's now starting to enter clinical trials, but isn't ready for prime time and hasn't been shown to be better than the standard ways that we give chemotherapy, which, as I told you, are much safer than the way we used to give chemotherapy at higher doses 20 years ago. And therefore, you know, there's less of a need to develop targeted strategies because we think that just by reducing the intensity of conditioning that we have made transplant much safer.
Thank you, Doctor. We have time for just one more question. What does your research show concerning early versus late transplant?
So I think the early versus late transplant is the best question is in the setting of autologous transplant. You know, we know that studies 20 years ago demonstrated that autologous transplant should be the standard of care for, we think, most patients with myeloma. But yet we know, if we look at the number of myeloma patients out there, that many are not getting early transplants and many are only getting transplanted later on. There is a large study that Dana-Farber and the French are doing, and we're hoping that there will be some preliminary results reported at the hematology meetings in December, looking at results of a new randomized study of patients who have gotten novel agents, or, you know, new agents like Revlimid and Velcade, looking at early versus late transplant, and we think we'll have some more information about that. In the context of allogeneic transplant, which of course has been our focus today, I would say that allogeneic transplant should probably really be considered in the early setting only for patients who have truly high-risk disease, either by those chromosomal markers or by the presence of plasma cell leukemia or adverse gene expression profiling results. The majority of allogeneic transplants are performed for patients who have relapsed post-autologous transplants. And again, and that's partially because we know that applying allogeneic transplant up front to everybody probably, you know, subjects some patients to harm who, you know, would do well with, you know, standard autologous transplantation. So I think for allo transplant setting, again, like the criteria for that BMT CTN study would be really for upfront, really only for the patients with highest risk disease and then in other patients who have failed autologous transplantation and perhaps other lines of therapy.
Thank you, Dr. Komandarai, for sharing all this information with us. I think those are some of the most simplest and clearest explanations of auto and allo that I have heard so far on the show. So thank you very much. Gary, Jack, and Matt, thank you so much for your participation, as always. And today's talk will be made available on CureTalk's website along with its transcript. Please visit curetalks.com for details of upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
It's really a pleasure.